Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. It was big news this week when it was announced that KWS, one of the world's major seed companies, had chosen St. Louis and the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center as the site of its North American research headquarters. It reaffirms the importance of the center and the world reputation it has gained as a plant science research facility since its founding in 1998. The center is working on many important projects with the potential of changing the way of life for billions around the world. I'm Don Marsh. With me to talk about the center and the good news announced this week about KWS are Dr. James Carrington, president of the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center. Sam Fiorello is chief operating officer and senior vice president for administration and finance and president of bioresearch and development, Growth Park, at the center. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thanks, you, Don.
Thanks for having us.
Jim, let me begin with you and just give us some indication of why this KWS announcement is so important and what it means.
Well, this is a big deal for not only the Danforth Center, but also the region. It was envisioned when the Danforth Center was founded in 1998 that we would grow this region to become a world center in plant science. And what that includes is vast commercial potential that we're already very strong in. But we envisioned a region where we would lead the world in innovation, based on plant science. Having KWS, the fourth largest seed company in the world, establish a major research headquarters in St. Louis is not only validation, but it's a very important milestone for us and one that we're really going to leap forward from.
Why did KWS choose St. Louis?
Well, that's a very good question, and the KWS team has been with us this week since the announcement, and they've made a very big deal about why they came to St. Louis. Sam can say more about this, and in fact, he's been on with an editorial about why they came. They came because of the community. What they saw that differentiated St. Louis from other competing communities they were looking at, Research Triangle Park, San Francisco Bay Area, Boston, they saw a community that had come together to share ideas, people, facilities, and a vision of high technology being applied to agriculture. They felt at home here. They came to the Danforth Center and saw a reflection of themselves in us. And what they meant by that was, these are people that we can work with. These are people that want to share. These are people who aren't looking at tomorrow. We're looking a year, 5 years, 10 years down the road. And so the values of KWS as a major player in the seed industry, they came here because they could move to where they want to get faster.
Sam, you know, there are a lot of people who have put down this community, but this is really an affirmation of St. Louis and its continuing emergence as a center for this scientific world, and also obviously an affirmation of the Plant Science Center.
Well, I think that's right, Don. You know, last December, we were on the short list. There were four locations they were looking at. And frankly, I think we were number four and being discounted some. And we said to the KWS leadership team, you really need to give us a chance to talk about the strengths of St. Louis. They had hired a site selection firm. They had had a brief visit. But there are some metrics that show up that don't show us in the best light. High crime and not a place of innovation, not a place where millennials or young scientists will come. We had a delegation from the Danforth Center, Bridge Park, the Regional Chamber, St. Louis Economic Development, the state of Missouri, and we got in a plane and we flew to Einbeck, Germany, where they're based. And we had a day with them and we said, listen, here's the reality of St. Louis, and come and spend some time, spend a couple days. They did. They followed up with a visit then in January, and they saw the incredible energy here, the innovation that's happening here, places like the Bridge Park and Cortex. They spent time with folks from Washington University. They saw the gems of Forest Park and the museums, and they got to talk to young millennials who had moved here recently, and they said, this is a lot different than the picture that we're reading about. And I think we have to do a better job as a community getting that brand the real brand out there.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. What kind of work will this company be doing here in terms of research?
They have plant breeders coming here. They have bioinformaticians, that is, folks whose job it is to mine big data sets. Initially, they're going to have wet labs as well as office space, and they're going to use quite a number of the Danforth Center's core facilities, things like greenhouses and growth rooms and growth chambers. Much of it the kind of work that we do at the Danforth Center, maybe a little bit further downstream with their breeding activities.
And this is coming, Jim, at a time of some expansion. You indicated looking out your window and seeing some construction going on. What is the expansion situation right now for the center?
Yeah, the center is expanding. It's a three-part program. We're putting up a new building that will house 100 new scientists. We're currently at about 225, 230 employees, about 160 scientists at the center now. We'll expand by about 100 when we fully occupy the building, which will be completed in fourth quarter 2015. The expansion also involves continuing to develop high-technology facilities that our scientists need. Some of those facilities, companies like KWS and other startup companies that are at Bridge and elsewhere in the region, can actually come and use. Part of the reason KWS came, to finish that point, actually, is they saw in the Danforth Center a tremendous facility with technology for bioinformatics, microscopic imaging, phenotyping, which maybe we can talk about later. They saw at the Danforth Center one-of-a-kind facilities that they could use on a on a pay-for-service basis, and it's nothing that can be duplicated, and it's nothing that you can find elsewhere in the world. So the expansion, new building, new people, new technology facilities.
Can you give me some sense of the variety of roles that plant science can make in making this a better planet?
Well, you've just given an entree to talk about why the Danforth Center exists. We exist to do good things in the world with plant science, improve the human condition using plant science. This is done in two broad areas: feeding the world and improving, preserving the environment. The feed the world piece, we have a big, big job to do on this planet through the 21st century, feeding a growing population and a worldwide population that expects a different diet than in times past. This is going to require that we increase agricultural productivity by about 70% by the middle of the century. Here's another way of helping you appreciate the scale of what we need to do. By the middle of the century, over the next 40 years, we have to produce more food through agriculture than what was produced in the last 8,000 years combined. We have the technology to do it now, but we would suffocate the planet if we used our current tools and technologies. To provide for the populations we expect and to feed them the way we expect that they will want to be fed, we don't have enough water to do it with current technology. So we need to breed better seed, and we need to bring science to crops that have been underserved by agriculture in places like sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. Crops like sweet potato and banana and cassava.
What do you mean you say suffocate the planet?
Well, we have agricultural technology that is really fantastic right now. Our agricultural industry in the U.S., in South America and other parts of the world is really amazing. But it uses, on the whole, a lot of natural resource, for example, fresh water. It uses a lot of fertilizer, which has the potential to, if not managed properly, has the potential to cause issues in waterways and oceans. We've made huge strides in improving water use efficiency, fertilizer efficiency, soil preservation, improving soil quality. We've made terrific strides with agriculture over the past several decades. But to achieve the productivity boost that we're going to need through the 21st century, we probably don't have those resources to use in the same proportion that we're currently using. Mm-hmm. Aquifers will be depleted. Freshwater supplies, we're in competition in agriculture with industry, personal household use. 70% of all human uses of fresh water around the world are for agriculture already. If we want to double that, we probably can't do it.
Sam, I've heard it said that water is the new petroleum, that before too very long, that's how valuable it's going to be.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I know that many books have been written about this, but I do believe that the next world wars will not be over oil, but fresh water. And Jim's exactly right. It's a huge limiting factor, and we've got to figure out a way to either get plants to thrive with less water, or perhaps plants that will thrive in brackish water. So you can strip some of the seawater out of it and get it to thrive. Today, they really can't. But things like that, we and others are working on. I gave a talk recently. It said, you know, to produce a kilogram of corn, it's about 900 liters of fresh water. A kilogram of wheat, 1,100. But a kilogram of beef is 16,000 liters. So as places become more affluent and those consumers want more protein in their diets, it puts an enormous strain on the fresh water on the planet.
What about the role of climate change in all of this?
Climate change is right at the center of the issues that we're talking about. Agriculture obviously depends on a suitable climate. You grow corn here in the Midwest, but you don't grow corn in the north of Sweden. It's because we have different local environments where corn is suited here. However, as climate change affects more of the world as it relates to agriculture, you will see zones that accommodate corn further and further and further north. Okay? But what that means is here in Missouri, what we're currently growing really well, we may not be able to grow as well. As you go to the west, you have places like Nebraska where you don't get the rainfall in western Nebraska that you get here in Missouri. Are we going to be able to grow what we grow in western Nebraska, which is a very fertile part of our agricultural land? Are we going to be able to grow what we currently grow in 50 years or 100 years if it's hotter and drier? And if we can't depend on rainfall, which western Nebraska doesn't depend on anymore, it depends on an underwater aquifer, if we deplete that aquifer, we don't have a lot of options today, which is why we need the science done now to prepare for the impact that we're going to see with changing climate.
I want to pick up on that point when we come back. We're talking with two gentlemen from the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center here in St. Louis. Jim Carrington, from whom you just heard, is president of that science center. Sam Fiorello, also with us in studio, chief operating officer and senior vice president for administration. And administration and finance, forgive me for putting it that way, and president of the Bioresearch and Development Growth Park at the center. We'll come back to continue this conversation, and of course we want to welcome your input as well. If you have questions for these gentlemen, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about the work being done at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center here in St. Louis. Two gentlemen from the center are with me in studio, Jim Carrington, president of the center, and Sam Fiorello, chief operating officer and senior vice president for administration and finance. Just continuing with this discussion about climate change and its impact, there are other things people don't normally think of, Jim. We think about drought and we think about flooding, but there are other things that we have to take into consideration, and you do at the center. What are they?
That's right. We have some teams that are working on this with partners at places like the University of Illinois, looking at the impact of, say, rising CO2 levels in the atmosphere and the impact on agriculture. Some really surprising things have been discovered recently. First, plants become more susceptible to leaf-chewing pests as CO2 rises. Very unanticipated. Here's another unanticipated discovery. The nutritional value of grain goes down in a high CO2 environment. It's not clear why, but there's some pretty good work that's been published over the past year that shows that the nutritional value on a per weight basis, growing grain at high CO2 levels that we can project are going to be here within the next 100 years could potentially lower the nutritional value, the amount of iron, for example.
We are talking about the genetic modification of plants, are we not? I mean, isn't that where we are, Sam?
Well, I'll let Jim handle that because he's the scientist in the group. And
we haven't been talking about genetic modification yet, although it's an interesting term, and I like to remind people that since the dawn of agriculture nearly 10,000 years ago, through farmers selecting the best performing plants in their plots of land, later in their fields, we've been effectively modifying the genetic composition of plants for 10,000 years. Corn, as you see it today, didn't exist 10,000 years ago. What was the starting plant for corn, you would call it inedible today. We've been genetically modifying through natural selection for 10,000 years. Now, over the past 25 years, we've been able to do very directed genetic modification, what now people call GMOs. The only thing that distinguishes a GMO from a conventionally bred plant is the addition of one or two genes that are introduced basically in the laboratory.
Why is this so controversial, not only here but in other parts of the world?
Well, that's a big, big question that has all kinds of angles to it. Early when the science and technology to genetically modify plants, to insert genes in the laboratory, initially in the early days in the 1980s, there were legitimate concerns about whether or not this is a safe technology, whether or not we would have some unintended consequences. But as the technology was developed and as experience was gained, then as GMOs were planted on millions of acres by millions of farmers around the world, we gained vast amounts of experience, and we learned that the technology as practiced around the world is a very safe technology, and science has shown through hundreds and hundreds of articles that there is no inherent danger that doesn't exist in conventionally bred plants. Now, so the concerns that you see are not based on science. They're based on lots of other things. And the concerns range from, well, with the precautionary principle, you know, we don't know everything, so let's not do it because we're not 100% sure. And, of course, we will never be 100% sure that something is 100% safe.
This doesn't work well with scientists, I know.
Well, it doesn't work well with some people. Another big issue is the organic industry has grown, and one of the differentiators of the organic industry, and one that frankly commands a price premium, is differentiation from conventional agriculture. GMO gets bundled with conventional. There's now, by the way, conventional products that are differentiated as non-GMO, but they're not organic. So there is a marketing piece here that involves a big industry.
Do you work with Monsanto on this? Because Monsanto obviously is very heavily involved.
Well, they are. They're not the only company.
Sure.
They have been the leader in the technology, and they were first to commercialize, and they have built a tremendous business. We talk with our friends at Monsanto frequently about this issue, about how to communicate accurate science to the public, science-based information to the public. We talk with them. We don't have formal projects per se around the issue of GMOs or GMO acceptance or labeling, for example. But we talk with them quite a bit because we're all concerned about this. Very importantly, we don't want to lose or have diminished a technology that can do so much good.
Well, in a sense, you would potentially be a competitor with Monsanto.
Well, no, we're not a competitor with Monsanto. Monsanto is a big seed business. We are a plant science organization. We're a nonprofit. We do, in fact, get into crop improvement through conventional breeding, and we do apply GM technology as well. But we tend to get involved in projects that Monsanto isn't commercializing. And this gets us to places like sub-Saharan Africa and improvement of cassava, banana,
things that sweet potato. That they use in that part of the world.
That's right.
Sam, let me come back to you. I don't know much about the Bioresearch and Development Growth Park. What is that?
That's a great question. From the very beginning, the inception of the Danforth Center, there were three mission points. One is to help with increased food production and food quality in the world. The second was a sustainable agriculture environmental piece. And the third was an economic development piece. And the idea, Don, was to create with the Danforth Center and affiliated park an enterprise that would be a magnet and something that would help both homegrown technologies, innovators, companies, as well as attract companies from other parts of the United States and the world to come here and say, if you're in the ag tech space, there's no better place in the world for you to build your company than here in the St. Louis region.
Such as KWS.
Exactly right. So our value proposition is embedded in our tagline, and that is research, resources, and relationships. So if you want to be close to some of the best plant research in the world, come here. We have more plant PhDs in our region than anywhere else in the world, with over 750. If you look at places like the Danforth Center and the Missouri Botanical Garden and Washington University and Monsanto, on and on. We also have in the Danforth Center on our campus some of the great resources, very expensive, things like specialized greenhouses and growth chambers and the other things that Jim talked about. If you add it up, it's tens of millions of dollars of capital investment and run by very specialized individuals who are highly trained. So if you're an early stage company, you can't afford to do that on your own. So you come into the park and you can drop in and you can use ours, and we charge you rent, but it's just in time. It's affordable. In fact, today we had a conversation. We're having conversations with a prospect, an Israeli company, and something they find very attractive is if they would have to go somewhere else and build their own greenhouses, it's $2-4 million several years, and they'd have to hire experts to run those greenhouses. We provide all of that on campus. And the third piece is a relationship piece, and it may be the one that's most amorphous but in some ways most valuable, and that is that we will insert you into a network of folks in the space, a network of investors and other innovators and thought leaders and big commercial enterprises so that you can very quickly move your business forward and grow it.
It's kind of an incubator concept, I gather. Sounds like it.
Incubator, in a different sense of word, because a firm like KBS is quite large. Mm-hmm. You normally think of a startup, but we have a mix of very early stage enterprises that very much need incubator-like services. We have mid-stage companies that have grown to a point and they are starting to have more and more things in-house. And then indeed some presence of very large international companies. That was always envisioned. We today, in Monday when we announced the KWS deal, it happened to be the fifth anniversary of the opening of Bridge Park, that first building. Today there are 16 companies and one training program. The first thing we did, Don, is we reached out to the St. Louis Community College and we partnered with them. They have a training program for technicians. One of the things that every company needs, and in fact places like the Danforth Center need, is just some skilled hands at the bench to do experiments. It's an underpinning of a laboratory. These are individuals not with PhDs. They just need to know how to run experiments. The community college has done a terrific job in creating this program. There are graduates of that program in every one of the Bridge Park tenants, as well as the Danforth Center and companies around our region. And it's terrific not only because of the opportunity and jobs it's giving to the individuals who go through the program, but it's also a very powerful attractor to companies that we're recruiting because they can see that workforce is right there.
Can you give me some sense of the kinds of research that are going on there now? I think you said it were 16 different companies involved.
So it ranges from alternative energy companies, so biofuels kinds of companies, companies that are looking to try to increase agricultural production. We have a food ingredient company. We have an Israeli technology that is looking to find ways to do things to ornamental plants so that they're healthier. Big data kind of data mining companies, a whole gamut. We have some companies that are involved in this relatively new area called biologics. So you look at, in this case, it's a company from Delhi, India. And they could have gone anywhere. They looked all over, and they decided on a region. And what they do is they have found beneficial microbes in the soil, in this case, fungi, and they have worked to enhance those. And when you coat these on the seeds, for example, soybean seeds, their field trial work has shown that the plants thrive, they're healthier, and they're more efficient at nutrient uptake. So,
is all of this work being done here, or do you have branches, for lack of a better word, in other parts of the world to test and do some research on the kinds of soils, for instance, that would be present elsewhere?
So for the Danforth Center, I'll let Jim talk to that. Our international work is very much a partnership-based, and I think this is a perfect time to talk about.
You know, the answer to your question is kind of yes and no. We don't have any branch stations that are, you know, Danforth Center at, in Kampala. But we have partners all over the world. In fact, that's how we operate. When we go into a project, whether it's funded by the Department of Energy or the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, if we enter into a project, they're all collaborative projects that involve partners at multiple institutions. Those that involve an international component have, in many cases, very elaborate international collaborations with organizations, government organizations, research organizations, and individual scientists in countries and geographies in which we work. So it's not a branch concept, but it's a partnership concept, and that really helps us extend our reach.
Sam, I want to come back to you for something you mentioned a moment ago when you were talking about biofuels. Mm-hmm. We've done programs with folks from the Plant Science Center before, and I was particularly interested in the work that was being done with algae. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some indications that algae could be the answer to our energy problems. Mm-hmm. Where are we on that?
You know, Don, I think Jim is best suited to answer that because not only it's a scientific answer, but also – so. In the Bridge Park today, there's no algae work going on, but Jim can talk about some of the work at the Danforth Center and others.
Well, let me start from the last thing you said. It could be the answer. We don't believe there is an answer. We believe, just like alternative energy broadly, wind, solar, renewables, and on, that answers to replacing fossil fuels for transportation and heating will come from many different places. So in the biofuel space from plants, we believe that there are many very good routes to be researching now that we think have very good prospects to pay off in the years ahead. Algae would be one because it doesn't compete with the food supply. You can grow it in controlled tanks, or you can grow it in open ponds. Very high oil density. That is to say, grow a pound of algae, you have a very high proportion, 70% or so, of that pound is going to be oil. So it's a very good source on a weight basis. There are challenges with algae. And that's growing it at scale. You need either big tanks or big open ponds. And so there are lots of issues. Ultimately, the issues come down to economics with algae. So we're researching algae to figure out how to improve the quality and quantity of oil. We're working at some early stages to breed algae. We would like to treat algae as a crop, like corn or soybean or tomatoes. It's a crop that could be bred where oil has been extracted and other products have been taken from algae. Those are mostly wild strains. I should mention, you know, algae doesn't just come out of the blue here. There's about a $5 billion industry based on things collected from algae, from cosmetics to food additives, feed, and so forth. So algae is actually part of our is an agricultural commodity already, but that's actually one of the challenges, because if you have products that you take from algae, the cosmetic applications are very valuable. Commodity oil is relatively cheap. So if you want to grow algae and sell product, what most of the companies are figuring out today is they're kind of drifting away from the biofuels and more towards specialty chemicals, which are very important. But it's an economic challenge that we're facing with algae. Other crops that we think have very good prospects, things like sorghum, or what's called energy sorghum, sweet sorghum, it's a very high sugar content. And it's easy to grow in the United States, and it grows to very high biomass. Lots of potential there. Oilseed crops like pennycress or camelina, which could be grown in rotation with corn and soybeans here in the Midwest or in the Northwest, in rotation with wheat. Lots of really interesting crops that we're working on now, some very basic research, some translational research that we're taking out to the field now.
It's really hard to believe that if you can extract oil from algae, and with gas at $3.65 a gallon right now, that it's more valuable for use in cosmetics.
Because the by comparison, that $3 or $4 is not very much.
Because cosmetics are expensive.
Yeah, it's why the fine chemicals business is has done so well.
All right. I have to take another break now. You just heard from Jim Carrington, who's president of the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center. That's what we're talking about today. Sam Fiorella was also with us. He's the chief operating. Did I say chief? I didn't mean to say that. He is the chief operating officer. Sorry about that. And senior vice president for administration and finance at the Science Center. Back to continue the conversation. Again, if you'd like to be a part of it, give us a call at 382-8255. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on what the work being done at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center here in St. Louis. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Opponents of a proposed constitutional amendment called Right to Farm rallied at the Missouri Capitol this morning. The question on the state's August 5th ballot asks voters whether the right to engage in farming and ranching should be forever guaranteed in the Missouri Constitution. The opponents say the proposal gives constitutional protection to animal abuse. Missouri Attorney General Chris Koster's office has reached an agreement with the owners of the Bridgeton landfill. It's aimed at better controlling underground smoldering and reducing a strong odor that has troubled residents for months. The agreement includes new measures to monitor the migration of the subsurface smoldering, which is generating concerns because it is near where Cold War-era nuclear waste is buried. St. Louis County Executive Charlie Dooley today unveiled his first television ads for his reelection campaign. One of the ads attacks his Democratic opponent, County Councilman Steve Stenger, who is already running his own campaign ads. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with regard to the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center. Sam Fiorello, let me come back to you with regard to the training that you mentioned a moment ago. What sort of training is going on, and who is being trained?
It's a variety of people. It's young men and women from North St. Louis who have just graduated from high school and who have a basic level of math or science that the program will take in and train them to work at the bench. If you don't have that level of math or science, they will take some people and give them math and science training to bring them to the level to insert them in the program. It's not so young people. Maybe if I give you a story of one individual, it'll help tell you how broad this is. I walked into a training room one day a few years ago, and there was a gentleman in there who looked like he was in his mid-40s. At the end of the training session, I went up to him and I said, "You've got a UAW T-shirt on. Can you tell me what's that all about?" He said, "Yeah, you know, I worked for many years at the Chrysler Auto Plant making parts for trucks. And I was displaced. I lost my job, and I went online, and I was a plant technician." And he went online, and the word plant and science technician popped up for the training program. And he thought, "What the hell, I'll give this a try." Got into the program after his first year. It's a two-year program. After his first year, he did really well. He had an internship at one of the Bridge Park tenant companies. Loved it. Second year, coursework went well. He graduated. That person is now one of our assistant directors of one of our key core facilities, tissue transformation. His name is Dave Busby, and it's those kind of stories that really make us excited. And there are many of those. Over 100 graduates. The placement rate's 98%, and And it's not 100% because two of the percentages decided to go back and get bachelor's and master's degrees.
So you're working with high schools as well as colleges and universities then?
Yes, we have an education outreach professional in-house, Dr. Terry Woodford Thomas, and she spends a lot of time with regional high schools, high school teachers, high school students. We have a training kit that we drop off at schools to help teach different biology modules, and she does a great job, and it's an important part of her mission.
We have other outreach programs where we actually bring the science being done at the Danforth Center into the classroom. One of the projects that Dr. Woodford Thomas runs is called Mutant Millets, and she does this in collaboration with one of our scientists, Tom Brutnell, where material is dropped off in the school. There's some coaching done, and the students are actually looking for interesting properties and variants in the stocks that we drop off. And then that information goes back to our laboratories, and it's actually used. So it's a wide range of outreach activities. Even more broadly than that, we've had over 500 trainees at the Danforth Center over the past 12 years. And this includes all the way from high school up to senior level visiting scientists who are coming to learn new technology and new science. We're currently in the 12th year of what's called the Summer Research Experience for Undergraduates program, where we have about 170 applicants for 16, 17 positions every summer. We can be very selective, and we get exceptionally good students, and they get immersed in plant science. And what are the outcomes of that? Well, half of those students go on to careers in plant science. And because there is, in fact, a real need for qualified, highly trained plant scientists, and we project that that need will increase in the future, and the statistics are bearing this out, that's a big success for us. It's a way to get scientists who might otherwise go into biomedicine or want to be physicians. If you can capture them at an early stage and show them the excitement of plant science, the nature and the importance of the problems they can solve in the world, the contribution they can have in their communities, like St. Louis, and we're capturing 50% of those as plant scientists for the future. We're very proud of that.
That's encouraging because we've done so many programs here on this program with regard to the STEM issues and the fact mm-hmm. there just aren't that many young people who are finding themselves attracted into this area. I'm sure that's a source of concern for you, or are you saying that that's turning around?
No, this is a big source of concern for us. STEM education, obviously, this is a big issue around the country. We experience it in many ways here in St. Louis, and as a science research organization, we're absolutely dependent on having STEM education that works in this country. We're very concerned that underrepresented students are not getting through STEM programs, and we're seeing this. And so we work very hard to get underrepresented students into our outreach and education and our training programs. Women, you'd be surprised to learn that through graduate school, very advanced training, our science, our STEM programs are about 50-50, men and women. But after getting the PhD, we see in the United States a drop-off in women in key positions. And so we have programs and a very specific objective to promote women coming into science, into STEM programs, getting training at the earliest stages. And then we work very hard to get women scientists and underrepresented scientists at the center into the highest levels.
And Sam, what are you seeing in this regard in your operation?
Well, in the businesses in the Bridge Park, it's critical for any of those businesses they can recruit, hire, retain talent. Scientific talent, business talent, innovators, entrepreneurs. And Don, I've seen the last 5 years that that pipeline really increased in St. Louis. Companies that can quickly add to their workforce. I think the innovation culture is really flourishing here in St. Louis, and that's something I'm really pleased with because I think we're going to really need that. You know, in the end, the Bridge Park, one of the big things I talked about the training program, we look at this as a critical jobs program. Bridge Park Building 1, there are currently 270 employees in that first building. If you look at when we build the second and third buildings and they're full, about 1,200 jobs. If you add the jobs from the Danforth Center, Phase 1 and 2, you know, what was a green field 15 years ago and just this vision and dream that Dr. Danforth had, in the coming years could employ 1,500 people.
Wow.
And these are 21st century jobs. I hate to use that cliche, but they're well-paying jobs. And it's something that we can be very proud of, and it's a trend that I think we desperately need in our region.
And as that critical mass forms, this is this community, this we part, that KWS found so attractive. So at the Danforth campus, you have about 575 people now in what used to be that green open field. That is really attractive to a KWS. And we can tell you that it's also attractive to a lot of companies that want to be close to KWS or close to Monsanto, strategic partners. As the critical mass grows, we will do better.
Speaking of strategic partners, what about the Missouri Botanical Garden? Mm-hmm. What sort of a relationship do you have with it?
Yeah, we have a very good relationship. The Missouri Botanical Garden is a real gem for science, and that's because they have one of the most amazing, extensive collections of plant species in the world, and they have some of the best talent that goes out and collects, categorizes, and characterizes these diverse species from all over the world. So where the Danforth Center works with the garden is for doing projects looking at, for example, natural variation. Let's say that you want to improve the tomato. Well, to improve tomato, the best way to do that is to collect as much diverse what's called germplasm, or enough a diverse collection of seeds and species and varieties, and then you start crossing them. But with modern technology, what you can use is great genomic technology to basically fingerprint the genetic identities of all these diverse species that the garden collects and that other found in other repositories around the world. And so the combination of high-throughput genetics and genomics that we do at the center with the amazing collections or natural variation that's represented at the garden, this is a real dynamic combination.
You know, suppose I don't want to improve the tomato. Mm-hmm. What I want to do is cure cancer.
Yeah.
And I did a story at the Botanical Garden years ago in which we looked at these shelves and shelves of things that have been collected. Mm-hmm. And the person I was speaking to said at the time, who knows, the cure for cancer might be in here somewhere. You know, we've got to go through all of this stuff
and all you
try
need
to figure
do is,
that out.
All you need to do is look back and say, yes, cures for some cancers have in fact come from plants. More broadly, about 25% of our medicines either still come from plants or were originally discovered as chemicals with some therapeutic value out of plants. Plants are the most amazing chemical factories. They make natural products that, for example, are involved in defending themselves against pests and diseases. But many of those chemicals also have therapeutic value for humans. Anti-cancer, as you mentioned. One of our researchers, Tony Kuchon, is working on chemicals that have some therapeutic value against to delay onset of Alzheimer's symptoms. There's just extensive lists of chemicals that come from plants. We need to do fundamental science first to understand how they're made and what they do, and we do a lot of that. Then we need to figure out ways to use those pathways, use that learning to produce chemicals at scale economically so that we can provide, for example, into a trial. This is a real bottleneck for a lot of chemicals and therapeutics that have very likely have value, but we simply don't have a supply or the supply is not reliable. Some of these chemicals that have therapeutic value, you have to hike up 5,000 feet in the mountains of Utah. And it's a finite resource when you depend on therapeutics, when you depend on hiking at 5,000 feet.
Of course, that would certainly make a difference. Sam, did you indicate earlier that medical research is going on amongst those 16 organizations that are working with you?
There, in some of the firms, there's a lot of crossover. So there's a gene sequencing company and those companies that do big data mining. You can apply those tools for both plant health and human health. So, it's although we say that's our area of expertise is plant and ag, again, those primary tools can be used for different areas. So we collaborate a lot with Washington University, both the Danforth campus and the medical school.
I'm sure much of what you're all doing over there is very sharply focused. Have there been any serendipitous discoveries that came right out of the blue and totally unexpected that you're aware of?
Well, this happens all the time. This is kind of the story of science. You're looking for something and you discover something else. There's an observation that we made. One of our teams made over the past year is a team led by Nigel Taylor, who's very involved in our international work. He works very closely with the team in the Institute for International Crop Improvement at the Danforth Center. And we learned something very unexpected about virus resistance in crop plants. And he's studying cassava. And he's got a technology where we can confer immunity against one virus, a virus called cassava brown streak virus. But through the course of his work, he figured out that there's another virus called cassava mosaic virus. And when you do some of the manipulations that he was doing to make brown streak resistant plants, you changed susceptibility to this other virus, a very unexpected finding. And this is how science marches forward. You make these serendipitous discoveries. You then get into the lab and you say, what's going on here? And you come up with ideas for what's going on, and then you test them. And the experiment shows you whether your idea is correct or not correct or something in between. That's how science works.
What is the most exciting potential for you right now? Is there something being worked on that is particularly exciting?
Well, we have a lot of exciting things, if you ask me. some of the work that we're very focused on has to do with increasing sustainability of food, feed, and biofuel crops. The issue of water is so important. So we have a lot of work understanding the natural basis for drought sensitivity or drought tolerance. We have programs involved with figuring out how plants take up nutrients from the soil, because if we can figure out how that works, we can use fertilizer much more effectively, and fertilizer becomes less of a potential pollutant. We have projects involving pest resistance, disease resistance that we think will have a big impact to people around the world. Those are just a few of the things we're really excited about.
We're going to have to leave it at that. It is ironic, though, isn't it, as the ice caps are melting, that water becomes an increasing issue on this planet. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on the KWS situation in which they have decided to join you at the Donald Danforth Planned Science Center. We've been talking for the last hour with Dr. Jim Carrington, president of the Donald Danforth Planned Science Center. Also with us in studio, Sam Fiorello, the Chief Operating Officer and Senior Vice President for Administration and Finance and President of BioResearch and Development Growth Park at the Center. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk about the 4th Annual Missouri Chamber Music Festival, the Muni's 96th season, and cellist Mac Heimovitz concert to open the 2014 Gesher Music Festival for emerging artists. Also, arts reporter Nancy Fowler will preview the latest installment in her Arts Game Changers series. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about current issues pertaining to the law with a panel of legal experts. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Kyle Jacoby, Amanda Honingfort, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.